Welcome to episode 11 of Techish Podcast with yours truly, Abadesi.
And me, Michael Behane, we back.
For an 11th episode, there's been a lot going on in the internet world, in the tech world.
In the interwebs.
In the interwebs, at the cross section of pop culture, social media, Twitter storms from the self-proclaimed Yeezus of the universe. Let's jump straight in, man. Let's jump straight into winners and losers.
Okay, so who's the ultimate loser? Are we starting off with the Kanye thing? I don't think we can avoid it, really. So
we cannot avoid this Twitter storm.
My boy, yeah, he's not my boy anymore, but yeah, yay. Where to begin, really? So, there's, you know, the thing is, it started off so positively in the sense that a lot of people were retweeting him when he was doing basically a lot of these kind of Buddhist-ish
one love podcast.
Yeah, like these one love type tweets where he was like, you know, stay positive and love the universe and whatever.
Yeah.
And then it slowly morphed into that. And the thing about me is that I'm able to detect when I'm able to detect ideology in a lot of stuff. So it was kind of like when he started saying stuff like, we don't need to succumb to like self-victimization. And then it morphed into, I love the way Candace Owens thinks.
Yeah.
So Candace Owens is a, I was going to say well-known. She's not really well-known. She's well-known on the internet.
America, baby.
She's well-known on the internet, in the internet circuit of like right-wing talk shows and whatnot. So she's an African-American
conservative
firebrand who's came out of YouTube essentially. And by the bootstraps.
Yeah, her message is basically that she doesn't like Black Lives Matter because she thinks that it is perpetuating a victim personality and a victim persona against Black Americans, which many people have responded to saying, I think you're kind of missing the point.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's been like, the right wing have kind of embraced her and taken her in, and you know, because they effort that message, which is stop whining and stop complaining, and you know, it's not white people's fault anymore. Like, you know, that kind of it's all your fault. Like, you know,
slavery was ages.
Yeah, slavery was a long time ago, man. You know, like
you got your reparations.
Single mothers.
Wait, hang on, no, you didn't.
Single mothers and you know the Black family and all that kind of stuff. Where it's like, the thing about those arguments where on their face value, I don't think it should be illegal to have those opinions. They should be debated. But obviously, to me, there's an agenda whenever most people have those arguments. It's not necessarily something where I feel like they have the best interests of Black people in mind when they present those arguments. It's more of an agenda of like, you know, the ultimate agenda is we want to cut all social services and all kind of safety net and all kind of provisions for healthcare, because we want people to feel like, even though it's not necessarily true that Black people use the welfare the most, it's not true, but the perception is that.
Yes.
So it furthers a right-wing agenda.
So
I had a debate with a friend of mine about this, and he was kind of saying, well, you know what, some of the things that she says, they're not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
And there should be a space for Black conservative thought, but to me, this is too far. I don't know. When you start criticizing Black Lives Matter and saying you're whining, these are people like,
people died.
Dead sons. Yeah,
yeah.
Like, these are mothers like that. I've got dead sons out here, like, and you're out here just trying to get famous on YouTube. Like,
well, this is the thing. You know, I actually think that Kanye West and Candace Owens have a lot in common, in the sense that they probably don't even necessarily agree with everything that they say, but they want to say things to be provocative and to garner attention.
We'll talk.
You know, I'm a big fan of the music that Kanye West makes, but it's very difficult now to kind of like take him as seriously as an artist, because there's definitely been like a departure in his, you know, very like pro-Black like stance. Probably maybe since he got married, I don't know. But, you know, we were talking about the MTV Awards and like all these times where he, you know, very explicitly kind of like stood up for what he felt was like unfair treatment of Black artists.
George Bush didn't care about Black people.
Yeah, you know, in the racial inequality in America. And what was so strange was then to like see him, you know, this meme floating around the internet of him with Trump wearing the hats. And it's kind of like, ugh, like when, you know, you have a president in power who's basically like creating like false narratives around all the good things he's achieved in the country. You know, he's already talking about a legacy when he's only like, you know, been a few years in, talking about all the positive trends that he's created, when in reality they're nothing to do with him. Trends around unemployment, etc. I think what's very frustrating, and like I share the frustration that people have felt, Chance the Rapper was very vocal about this. You know, fine, Kanye is using the system to promote, you know, his agenda, but he is being used even more, you know, to the detriment of his community. Like, I am all for, you know, Machiavellian, you know, let's get in with the people in influence, let's get in with the people in power. I'm going to be someone that, you know, wears all these different masks depending on the situation to further myself and make progress. I don't necessarily disagree with that kind of tactic, but I think when you are someone with such a large audience, I mean, he literally lost like 3 million Twitter followers or something crazy. Something crazy. Like that.
It fluctuated, after so nobody knew the actual number, but yeah.
But in the millions.
In the millions. A lot of celebrities unfollowed him and whatnot.
And I just think, you know, when you're an artist and everything that you've achieved is off the back of other people who have invested in you, like literally time and money, it probably does, you know, feel like a bit of a like slap in the face to now kind of like U-turn in a way.
Yeah.
It feels a bit like a U-turn.
Yeah. You know, and he's always talking about, you know, being a free thinker. But what happened to being a critical thinker? Because he's actually said in the past, like, I don't read books. Like, I just yeah, he said that. He's like, I don't read books. I'm like, because you know, like the artist type where they think all they need is their internal creativity. And there's nothing wrong with that. But
the voices in their heads.
Exactly. So when it comes to political matters, I don't think he even really knows or cares particularly about what Trump's policies are.
But that's probably why him and Trump get along
exactly.
so well.
He resonates with, I don't know if Trump knows his policies either, but...
Exactly, that's what I'm saying, neither of them read.
He resonates with Trump in the sense of his persona.
Right.
The kind of...
Narcissistic,
but the sheer force of will to bend the universe into your own... to your own will, essentially. The fact that he steamrolled the Republicans and he wasn't a typical politician. Those are the things that Kanye admires. So Kanye sees probably himself in that because he now wants, and he thinks that Trump's opened a door for his presidential run in the future as well because he said that he wants to run for president at a certain point.
That's hilarious. Well, he's just like alienated like most black people. So
100%. And this is the danger when you don't, you know, look into things too deeply and you get enamored with your own sense of self and your own sense of creativity. Like, look at what Trump's doing, the impact that he's having on people that you say that you care about. Like, you know, black and brown people are getting screwed by Trump. So, and Trump's come out and said, you know, there were good people at that white nationalist rally. There were good people there. Like, he said that. Like, this is an overtly, you know, I don't think there's been an administration in my lifetime that's so closely aligned with white supremacy. Like, I'm not going to say white nationalist, or I'm just going to say white supremacy.
Of course. I mean, so, that's like, what it is. If you think that white is a superior race than others, then that's a white supremacist view.
Completely. And for Kanye, somebody who was so well-loved in the black community to just... 180 and just align himself. I'm sure it's hurt a lot of people. And a lot of people are just like, whoa, like, do we support this guy? I mean, I've never been his biggest fan. I like his music, but I'm not, you know, hurt by it. But I'm sure some people are.
I think it's also really interesting to think of, like, you know, what role do celebrities play in influencing, like, our political landscape and then also influencing our political views? Because, you know, in previous episodes, we've talked about how social media networks have inadvertently influenced people's decisions and potentially made an impact on you know, how elections, governments, elections, what governments rule. You know, to what extent then do, like, celebrities, like, hold similar influence? Because the thing is, you know, even though celebrities say, you know, come out and vote, or I'm voting here and I'm voting there, does that ever affect you personally? Like, if someone, just because I like the music you create doesn't mean I necessarily agree with your vision of the world.
I think celebrities affect politics, but not in the way that most people think. It might not necessarily be like vote for this candidate, but politics is the affairs of managing society and life. So when a rapper is talking about French champagne or German car, that to me is political. And those are the artists that we say are non-political. We say there's a division between conscious rappers and non-conscious rappers, for example, right? So when the mainstream narrative in rap, for example, is about European brands and European aesthetic, and for example, that to me is political statement. You're basically saying that, you know, these are the superior things that I want to align myself with, as opposed to Asia, Africa, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So celebrities and music, especially rap, it has massive political connotations. Never has a, you know, such a high level rapper who's, you know, an all time great so closely aligned himself with a politician who's so reviled in the black community. This is a new one. Do I think Kanye's going to turn anybody and make black people think, okay, maybe Trump's not too bad? No. So
yeah, exactly.
He has no influence in that sense. I don't think so.
But like, is there a danger, perhaps, you know, Trump then sent this tweet out saying, like, oh, you know, Kanye and Chance, you know, calling them legends and they really get it. Is there a danger that for the people who really doubt that there is social injustice, you know, in America, does this kind of like validate that fake news that everything is fine and it's not that bad to be black in America and everything's, you know, being overstated? The fact that Trump can basically kind of use these guys like puppets. I mean,
I don't know. It's difficult to tell. I mean, Trump's always parroting the line about black unemployment is the lowest that it's ever been.
He's
a master at, like, I think he's kind of like a savant. He doesn't necessarily know what he's doing, but he's a master at just pushing a narrative and just not giving up. And just
Expert manipulator.
He's a genius marketer to a certain extent. Not even like an intentional one. I think he's just natural good at marketing.
No, he's actually learned lots of these tactics from one of his advisors. Yeah, it's been written about in like the Washington Post.
Fascinating. I didn't know that, because he just constantly repeats the narrative of black unemployment is the lowest it's ever been. And that, you know, I don't think anybody's going to be swayed by that, because the reality is people on the ground know that, you know,
Incomes are falling,
and you know, it's not a great time for anyone who's working class, let alone the black working class. So,
I one of the things that I would like to know, and I really hope it's uncovered at some point soon, just because I'm curious, you know, what are the circumstances that led to this meeting? Because, you know, you're the president of the United States of America. Like, what part of your agenda is like, oh, 30 minutes with miscellaneous hip-hop artist, you know?
Trump is a reality TV star.
Well, this is the thing. I reckon
he's more comfortable in this world than he is in the Senate or the Congress. Yeah, yeah. Like,
I actually reckon that his team are always trying to, you know, get photo opportunities with him 100%. And various underrepresented people to show, look, he's not racist. Like, yeah, his 100%. Dad was in the KKK, but he's fine. And, you know, most people probably reject these invitations. So, like, you know, Jay and Beyonce, no thank you.
Yeah.
Kanye gets it. And obviously, he's part of the Kardashian TV empire. Yeah. And they are like a brand that's public on the stock market, right? Like, it's like they literally move in value with every tweet that's written about them and every Instagram like. So they get this invitation. And any other person with a bit more integrity might have been like... No. Whereas they're just like, oh, this is like a press opportunity.
Even Steve Harvey met Donald Trump. I think in the beginning it was difficult, because I think a lot of people thought we would be shut out from the conversation if we don't go. So I think Steve Harvey was even advised by Obama to like, yeah, just go, because, you know, we need to build bridges. That whole cliche, for example.
Yes.
But the Kanye meeting is different, because the full backstory is that Obama kind of shunned Kanye and Kim. He called Kanye a jackass, like, by accident on national TV during the whole Taylor Swift incident.
Yeah.
And that was quite, like, that footage was leaked. So Kanye was kind of rebuffed by Obama. And, you know, the Obama presidency is when a lot of rappers went to the White House. It was kind of like, it was like, you know, it was the hip hop president, we're in, you know what I'm saying? So when Trump made overtures to Kanye, I'm sure he loved it. It fed into his ego to a certain extent.
Yes.
And he's come out and said, and Kanye tweeted, Obama didn't do anything for Chicago, blah, 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 you know, which wasn't technically true. He had this program called My Brother's Keeper. I don't know the details of it, but the first thing Trump did when he came into the office is he shut it down. So, like, it's factually untrue. But I don't think that necessarily matters to Kanye. You know, Kanye and Trump, they kind of strike me as the kind of people that care more about feelings than actual... They kind of go...
They're very childish in their reactions.
Yeah.
No, immature.
And he said, like, me and Trump were the same. We've got dragon energy. And I was like, people are like,
come on now.
But to me, I understood what they meant. They both meant, he kind of just meant
this kind of.
He breathes fire. Yeah, basically. Just like they kind of go off feeling and gut, and they just kind of do what they just, it's like childish energy. They kind of do what they want, and they make the world bend to them as opposed to the other way around.
Right.
But yeah, it's what I wanted to ask you actually is, what is the space, what is the conversation surrounding black conservatism? Is that something that, so because the criticism of Candace Owens, I thought mostly was warranted. I don't necessarily think that she's genuine, to be honest. But a lot of people were upset about the fact that there was just like a divergent opinion.
Right.
That was put into the conversation.
Mm.
So what are your thoughts around, you know, having different ideological perspectives within, say, a group?
I mean, obviously it's going to happen. Like, race is a social construct, you know? I don't, I mean, I have to subscribe to it, but I don't believe that just because, you know, we are all the same race, like, we have to necessarily all vote for the same party. Because, yes, black people in America have a history of oppression, continue to be oppressed, but both parties were, you know, complicit in creating that oppression. You know what I mean? Like, Abraham Lincoln was a racist. He didn't necessarily want to abolish slavery, but he just had to.
And he was a Republican as well. Which is confusing. He was a Republican.
Yes.
So the this is a talking point that Republicans throw out, is that
they abolished slavery, right?
And the Democrats were historically the racist ones.
So, you know, I think it's fine. I think it's good for people. If anything, it's good for people to be talking about political influencers and political thought leaders at that age, because before people were saying young people don't vote and young people aren't interested. And mm-hmm. now we've seen, you know, with the recent high school shootings in America, organized marches, lobbying politicians, now with like Black Lives Matter and other movements, and, you know, all the other affinity groups as well, like mm-hmm. Muslim people, Jewish people, the queer community, everyone that's been sidelined by having like the most misogynistic, openly misogynistic, racist president in history, are just vocalizing, you know, what change they want to see. And I think it's such an oversimplification to be like, oh, there are no black Republicans, or there are no rich Democrats.
I think the question I was asking is that, is there a space for somebody who aligns themselves with things that are generally antithetical to what the majority of, you know, black people might subscribe to? So, to be honest, Candace Owens has been kind of accepted open arms by the alt-right, essentially.
Yeah.
So what do we say about somebody like that? Do we have to engage with that person, or can we just be like, I'm not trying to hear it? Do they deserve a platform, is what I'm saying?
I see. Would you have somebody like that on the podcast? She's a bit of a troll.
So would you ever have her on a podcast?
I mean, I guess I'd have to think of what my podcast is for, or why I'm doing it. If the purpose of my podcast is to encourage like debate and open political thought, then yeah, I would. I'd bring everyone on it. I mean, I'd probably tease them and ask them ironic questions. But
yeah, you got to.
What do you think?
I don't know, to be honest.
I mean, we can't say, like, you know, we need to have freedom of speech. She's not saying things to incite hatred or violence, but she has her own agenda. Let's face it, she has her own agenda.
And what I'm saying, yeah.
Anyone who thinks a bit critically about the situation will see that and take it for what it's worth.
I mean, there are black conservatives that I have read, like Thomas Sowell. He's like a free market economist type stuff. I don't agree with it, hardly anything he says, but I've read his works. So if you're a genuine person who subscribes to certain economic theories, you think the free market works better than socialism, okay, we can have that debate. But when I see you, when I get any vibe that I feel like you're just doing it for attention, like she kind of does, and, you know, just chastising Black Lives Matter, like,
well, this I'm
just,
is where this, I draw
that's
the line.
That's where I draw the line, exactly. Mm. That's why I'm like, I wouldn't give this person a platform. I don't think you're genuine. If you can always tell when somebody's coming at something out of love, because don't get it twisted, there are people that are, that a lot of people support, that have said some of the things that she said. Like, for example, you know, we shouldn't just see ourselves as victims. If that's coming from a place of love, where you're like, okay, we shouldn't see ourselves as victims, therefore we should, A, you know, work together, build businesses, you know,
invest in each other,
blah, blah, blah. Yeah. That's cool. But if you're going to be like, we shouldn't see ourselves as victims, full stop, I'm chastising you.
Yeah.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps and no suggestions, nothing constructive. That's when I'm going to be like, what are you doing this for? Are you just doing this so that you can get a pat on the back by your alt-right buddies so they can say, look, these are the things that we can't say.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a white conservative can't necessarily go on TV and chastise African-Americans. They just can't do it. So what they do is they get the spokesperson.
This is the thing. That's why I was about to say, like, I kind of question their motivations and authenticity, because whenever you see these like mouthpieces where they're literally just like contradicting the movement, right? Mm. So it's like, oh, look, I'm a black person and I disagree with Black Lives Matter.
Mm.
Or like, oh, look, I'm a Jewish person and I agree that, you know, we've gone too far with political correctness. Like, all of those people to me always just appear like trolls. Yeah. It's like they're
well-paid trolls, though.
You know what I mean? Like,
they're well-paid trolls.
Yeah, they're well-paid, but it's all a strategy, it's all a tactic, and I feel that you have to just be smart enough to recognize that and be like, you're just not real. Because when it comes to oppressed people, when it comes to people who, you know, literally lives are in danger because of the discrimination that exists in the world, to then be a part of that oppressed group, that would be like me standing up and be like, do you know what, guys, gender equality, it's gone too far. Like, yes, 9 out of 10 women in the UK work for a company that literally pays them less to do the same job as their male peers, but I'm fine with that.
You would make so much money if you would like to be like, you know what, feminism, it's not real, we don't need it. And you know what, now I'm conservative and now I've realized the error of my ways, and, you know, feminism, you need to shut up. You would make so much money. You'd go on book tours. You would you'd be on Breitbart.
All the angry men would be like, finally.
Exactly, because you would be the spokesperson saying the things that they could never say.
Yeah.
Anyways, we'll come back to this. I mean, you know what? The thing about this is that it's such a fast-moving subject that I'm sure by the time this releases, there'll be new developments and whatnot.
Amazing. Yeah, agreed.
Next story is, I would say this is a... I don't know who's the winner or the loser here. So one of the WhatsApp founders has now parted ways with Facebook. If you know the backstory, obviously Facebook acquired WhatsApp for a handsome sum. I think it was about 19 billion at the time. And so Yang Kum, who was the chief executive and co-founder of WhatsApp, he's left the company, and it's primarily over disagreements regarding privacy and encryption. So, you know, one of the core values of WhatsApp, in fact, it was a paid product at first because they promised that we would never do ads. And we very much believe in privacy. And then they introduced encryption end to end. And now I think Facebook, you know, as a public company and its pressures that it has to have, you know, a profitable, say, it has to make money, basically.
Yeah.
They are trying to now put in business tools where companies can kind of target consumers using the application. And they want to weaken the encryption. So that is one of the issues where Yan has been like, you know what, I'm falling back. So I wanted to ask you... is this what happens when... And we talked about this earlier because one of the other co-founders said hashtag delete Facebook.
I was going to say.
But this dude had stayed on board and was actually on the board of Facebook at one point.
Yeah.
I think the other guy, Brian Acton, I think his name was, he had actually left the company.
Already,
so now both of them have left now.
Interesting.
And, you know, we talked about it last time. When you sell your company...
Yes.
Do you lose the right to kind of, you know... to call into question the direction of where it's going? Like it's clearly
you do.
He got into bed with the devil, essentially. Facebook was
sold his soul to the devil.
I mean, to me, they're not the devil, but if you are somebody who prescribes to the fact that advertisement is the wrong business model and privacy should be key, you don't sell to Facebook. It's like selling to the completely antithetical to what you say that you believe in.
But I think it's, you know,
it would be like me selling Pocket to Breitbart. And then be like,
that's
guys,
extreme.
Like,
that's
guys,
extreme.
What's going on here? Like,
why would Breitbart even buy it?
I'm joking.
So that they can like find people to target and troll. I think you absolutely do like lose the opportunity to have that direction. I mean, you know, $19 billion. It was like mostly cash with a few shares, and it's kind of hard to walk away from that. And like, also remember that, you know, depending on how much you've raised to a certain point, like the decision isn't necessarily fully yours as the founder as well.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point.
I think we also have to remember that, you know, Cambridge Analytica has kind of like blown this abuse of use of data like totally out of the water, because we always suspected with free products that our data was being sold and used and whatever. And people are still building freemium apps and launching freemium companies all the time on this model. But what we don't like about it is just the way that it's been abused. So this lack of transparency. Mm. And I think, you know, when you think of like encryption and like data protection, what's nice about that is that it's like, okay, so I can assume that anything that's not encrypted is basically open for everyone to eventually mine or hack or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've built a product whose sole purpose is to protect that, you know, so really just like help individuals maintain a boundary between their private and their public life. That's certainly to be commended. That's why WhatsApp's been so popular. And I think what they realize now is, okay, like Facebook is not interested in helping people maintain a boundary between their private and public life, because the more of a private life you have, that's an opportunity cost for Facebook, right? Like the less of a commercial opportunity they have. So, you know, probably at the time of being acquired, they didn't fully realize this vision of the world that Facebook has created. You know, even when I first joined Facebook, maybe 10 years ago or something, I was just like, oh, sweet, connecting people. This is awesome.
Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't see this kind of dark side of it where it's basically trying to like infiltrate every single layer of my life. And now it's kind of like, whoa, not cool with that. So I actually think this is more of, you know, a way for him to protect his own integrity and his own beliefs as a person, because, you know, privacy, our sense of freedom is something which has been debated for like thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and people still continue to talk about it in academic circles and philosophy, in the internet, everywhere you go. So I think, you know, it is something that is super personal. And if you built something which is really just to protect, you know, make sure that every single person still has some safe space, which, you know, only they control, only they know. And you see that the company you work with is on a mission to shift people's mindsets away from wanting privacy and away from wanting that space, I mean, you have to walk away, right?
Yeah, you do have to walk away.
That's what I think's happened here.
I think he thought he could change it from the inside. He actually, when the company was acquired by Facebook, he insisted on a board seat. So I think that was his way of saying, okay, I need to have a say in what the actual overall vision of the company is and, you know, protect what we've built.
Yeah.
And I think he's just realized that he just can't. The company is, when a company gets at that scale, it's too many moving pieces and you have very little impact. One voice has a very little impact. And, you know, they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to make as much money as possible. WhatsApp is sitting on, I think, almost a billion users in of itself. And something's got to give. They had, and you know, I liked WhatsApp in the beginning, actually, when they just charged you for the app.
I like that too. I remember it was like a dollar or something for a year, right?
I think it was a dollar for the year. And I think the only issue with that is that, so I think Facebook, somebody calculated that Facebook probably makes about 10, I'm not going to quote the number. It was a certain figure that per head that they make on each user, just based on how much money they make on advertisement divided by how many users they have. And it's certainly more than $1 a year.
Yeah.
So I don't think in the long term that was the model they wanted to go for.
Yeah.
And also going into like, you know,
it was $6.18 in Q4 2017.
Okay, so in one quarter they make $16 per user, right? I mean, we can fact check that later.
But
the point I'm making is also is that, you know, they wanted to go into the global south and, you know, India, Africa, and that maybe that $1 per year is too prohibitive and might slow down their growth. Growth is king, apparently.
I have a lot of admiration for him, is like one thing I'm going to say, because like you know, we talk a lot about this idea of like weighing good against growth and, you know, overall good against profit, etc. It must be pretty friggin' cushy to be a senior executive at Facebook. Like
100%.
You're going to be on a ridiculous salary, netting how many thousands and thousands every month. You're going to have ridiculous benefits, you know, in America, which has like no welfare system. You're going to have free food, go on whatever training you want, expense everything, go on conferences, la-di-da-di-da. If you're just living at that like superficial level and not thinking in the long term and not necessarily thinking about the impact that your actions make in wider society, you can kind of just stay there.
He's a billionaire already. What does he need that stuff for?
Yeah, it's true. But, you know, like there's like loads of billionaires that don't do anything and don't give anything and are just like...
But I mean, if you're somebody who's driven and you've got $1 billion, like if I gave you $1 billion, obviously for a long
period... I'd be like, bye.
You'd be like, bye, Michael. This number is not answering. I should have to call you. But the point I was going to make is that you'd still be driven to, you know, pursue your world vision. Just like that speech that Chamath gave where like, that this dude can easily go out there and build the next
competitor
if he wants to, really and truly. So I don't think money was the reason why he stayed around. I think he stayed around because
maybe he just waited for shit to vest.
Maybe.
And then was like,
yeah, maybe.
Deuces.
Maybe, yeah. Would you care like who you sold to, basically? Like does it make a difference who you sell to?
Interesting.
I think I asked you last time, would you sell Hustle Crew? I couldn't think of an example, but like selling Hustle Crew to, you know, a company where on the face of it, they claim that they care, but you deep down know that they don't really care about your vision.
It's so funny because as you say this, I'm wondering, is it fair to say that Facebook really doesn't care?
Oh, no, they care, but they just care about different things. They care about making money, which
but the
is,
thing is
they,
like,
what they have to
you
do.
You know, maybe they have their own little like cognitive dissonance thing going on where they like equally care about making the world more connected and making it easier for people to connect with each other, you know, democratizing whatever.
Yeah, I don't think privacy has ever necessarily been one of their core tenets or their core values, whereas I think with WhatsApp it was. I think if you ask them, number 20 down the list would be, privacy.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And obviously what's happened with the Cambridge Analytica has shown that it's probably... 20 might be a bit of a reach.
Yeah. I think, I guess I would just think of the, I'd have to make the decision based on like what's best for my community. You know, Hustle Crew is a community. So, you know, the thousands of people in it, like trust me to like do things which will make tech more inclusive. That's literally everything that I do. So if I truly believed that the company prioritized that principle, then I would do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, only if I could kind of know that with some certainty, I think.
I think it's very interesting. I think how many happy endings are there where the person sells their company and then, you know, it's a happy ending. Obviously, financially, it's a happy ending for that founder. But a lot of times the product gets shut down.
Vine.
The product,
so sad.
The product gets shut down. The product gets changed or integrated into the existing products that the company has.
Yeah.
Or yeah, the product just disappears. And
it's so like, sad. It's this winner.
It happens so often.
It's because of this like winner takes all approach to acquisition, because a lot of the time, you know, especially in the tech space, you know, VCs can be quite vicious. So we all watch Silicon Valley sitcom and stuff. You know, sometimes you acquire your competition just to shut them down.
Yeah.
Or you acquire a whole company just because you need one engineer who refuses to leave.
Like, yeah.
There are very short-sighted tactical moves which you make maybe for that specific company to benefit in the long term, but not necessarily for society as a whole. And that's kind of tragic. Okay, cool. So we've got some winners this week. The graduating class of Founder Gym's second cohort, which is pretty exciting. So Founder Gym is quite literally a gym for founders, underrepresented founders. Their CEO is the incredible Mandela Dixon, who used to work at K4 Capital, who do a lot of work around tech inclusion. And as someone who really is a Silicon Valley insider, what she wanted to do is level the playing field in her own way and, you know, create this school, this training center where underrepresented founders can learn all the things that probably don't get published in TechCrunch articles and blogs and podcasts about what it really takes to, you know, take your company to the next level and win that investment.
Raise that moolah.
Raise that money, build that board, grow your customers, etc. So I wanted to, first of all, just kind of shout out Mandela Dixon, because I think it takes incredible courage and resilience to do the kind of work that she's doing. She's been able to find, you know, incredible teams of people to be involved in terms of the actual education piece. But even better, she's been able to find an incredible range of founders. And some of the stats that they've published about cohort two are just so inspiring and just show the extent to which a false narrative around, you know, pipeline for diverse founders is 52% female, 43% male, 2% trans male, 2% trans female, 64% black, 24% white, 14% Asian, 10% Latinx, 2% Middle Eastern. Again, like, the diversity goes across other dimensions. Age-wise, 24% in their 20s, 52% in their 30s, 21% in their 40s, which I thought was great, 2% in their 50s. We've discussed in the past whether tech has a, you know, age discrimination problem. So the fact that a fifth of their people were, you know, in their 40s, I thought was like super promising and shows that they're not being blinkered in how they approach it. Parenting status, you know, 50% with children, 50% without. These are representative numbers. These are the kind of people that I feel more comfortable about, you know, investing in my future and building the products that will determine my future.
It's far closer to what society actually looks like as opposed to what we normally get.
Exactly. This was also super interesting, I thought, given what we were talking about last week with, you know, founder Karl Martin shutting down his app Ping. Only 57% are full-time founders.
Only 57%.
Yeah, so a little over half. So then they have 29% with one part-time founder and a full-time employee. It's a really interesting model. And another 14% part-time founder and part-time employee. Now, in many ways, these figures are turning on the head all these assumptions that we hear, you know, big VCs talking about, you know, oh, if you're not both working on your problem full time, you're not investor worthy, you're not ready to get investment yet. By the way, almost 70% of their products were already in market. So, you know, it's not just like, oh, are these just in conception stage? No, they are real. Only 10% of all of these people I've just mentioned have a product which is still in development. 41% had no previous experience in raising funding, which is, you know, not surprising. 52% are non-technical. It's really, really...
it's commendable work, really.
It's just amazing. And I want this to be a reminder to people that the stories that are repeated in the press are not necessarily reflective of reality and not necessarily true. And we really have to remember that. And there are so many people out there who, you know, are underrepresented and are working on side hustles or entrepreneurial projects who are probably holding themselves back right now from taking the step that they should take. I would love for there to be Founder Gym in, you know, the UK, Mandela, if you want to set it up, holla, like, we'll sort you out.
I was going to say, you should do this.
But, you know, I met a founder yesterday, and he's basically got an app it's really cool. He's got a technical co-founder, actually like built a team around him. He's bootstrapping. And I said, okay, how many investors have you spoken to? And he said, I'm not ready yet. And I was like, well, no one's ever ready to speak to investors.
Yeah, we'll talk.
But I was like, you know, with Hustle Crew, I left it way too late because I just didn't have the confidence.
Mm.
It came down to confidence. I wasn't ready for someone to shut me down and destroy my ego. But the reality is you have to do that. Like, unless you want to bootstrap forever, like you need to fail fast. If your idea is not suitable for investment, you want to find out sooner rather than later. Otherwise, you're just like running your savings dry.
And also, if speaking to one investor doesn't, and if they say no, doesn't mean that you're not suitable for investment. You have to speak to many and see what's
exactly.
out there.
Exactly.
Like,
but that's what I mean. Yeah. So it's a very laborious, time-consuming process, and you want
to
make sure you're
doing enough
of it.
And that's why people have to, like, Founders Gym is there to coach people through the process because, you know, I'm sure first-time founders might get disheartened or they think, well, you know, maybe this isn't for me, especially when you think that you don't look like what a typical founder is supposed to look like.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's
and you need to know
really
what's normal, right? So it kind of like normalizes that and makes you think, oh, okay.
I think they raised, like, cumulatively their first cohort raised $1 million. So that's amazing.
That's amazing. I mean, that is just incredible. So yeah, like, please, everyone, like, you know, check out Founders Gym.
And if you're in the States, have a look at applying for their third cohort. Maybe
yes,
I'm sure
absolutely.
The second cohort is closed up. But
any listeners in San Francisco as well, I saw that Mandela had tweeted that she's doing a live event with Ellen Powell from Project Include.
Yeah.
Previously an employee at Kleiner Perkins, wrote an incredible book about her experiences there called Reset, which I highly, highly recommend everyone read or listen to on Audible or whatever. But yeah, if you're in SF, like Mandela and Ellen Powell, just, you know, put it into a search engine and book a spot. It's a free event, I think.
Yeah. And also, I think actually just a side note, I think anybody can apply for Founder Gym. It's not just US.
Yeah, that's
based.
True.
So they have like a certain percentage of people.
I think almost 20% of people are non-US.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
In their last cohort. So yeah, check it out.
Fly away.
But what do you think about Amazon making an Echo Dot for kids?
It doesn't surprise me.
Doesn't surprise
you? Yeah, it's a bit creepy. I think these companies are very much trying to wedge their way into like the younger demographics. Facebook had a messaging app for 13-year-olds, I think it was.
Yeah, 13 and under. Oh,
and so this is prior to the whole Cambridge Analytica thing, so they kind of got, I think it's been either pushed back or just kept under the wraps for a bit now.
Yeah.
But I'm wary of it. I mean...
I just think, you know, it really, sometimes in capitalism, we are just sinister. Like, we don't realize what we're, you know, what we're doing in trying to build, you know, companies that grow. I was going to say profitable companies, but actually there are a lot of companies that aren't even profitable within like tech and startups. But we forget that we're just doing super evil things. Like, okay, from a business perspective, I get this idea of like, get them while they're young. You know, Amazon's projecting revenues into the decades into the future. And they're saying, okay, you know, baby boomers, they're like retiring soon. They're going to be, you know, on their pensions, maybe not spending as much. Then we've got like Gen Z and like, okay, they're all right, but, you know, could be spending more. Then we've got the millennials and they're broke AF, so allow that.
Yeah.
And then it's like Gen Z, okay, yeah, cool, we're trying with them. And now they're like, oh, but we got to think ahead. Like, what do like kids want? Like, how do we anticipate what their needs are and make them addicted to our services and make them sticky? I mean, Jeff Bezos, for the very first time, published the figures of Prime users.
Over 100 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
And very shortly after, announced the price increase for Prime subscriptions in the US.
Which is like,
so, you know, their ultimate goal will be, how, I guess, do we just groom them? It's kind of like grooming, isn't it?
That's, I mean, I wouldn't call it grooming, but I mean, it's, you know, it's existed long before these tech companies were around. If you look at McDonald's, like Happy Meals, what is that?
Yeah,
it's a way of
brainwashing.
Yeah, it's brainwashing. It's a way of getting the consumer while they're young so that when they grow up, they have positive feelings towards your product. They know your product and they want to carry on consuming your product. It's about getting a customer for life.
Yeah.
You know?
Lifetime value.
Exactly. So this is what Amazon is trying to do.
Will you be buying one?
Absolutely not. The most annoying thing is, I mean, I don't have any kids, but if I did, I wouldn't. Because I know that most of these tech executives keep most of this technology stuff away from their children.
Exactly.
That's the crux of it. Steve Jobs was known for saying, I keep stuff away from my kids.
Mm.
You know, Tim Cook came out saying he doesn't let his little nephews go on Facebook, you know, and I'm sure even Mark Zuckerberg is not like, you know, pushing.
Oh, yeah,
all
his
Facebook
kid doesn't have a Facebook profile.
I mean, they're quite young, obviously, and you're meant to be above 13 to have a Facebook profile, I think. But, you know, so I'm going to follow their example. Why, like, if these guys are not willing to take their own medicine, why am I going to do that?
Yeah.
Essentially, right? Yeah, it's not great. It rubs me up the wrong way. I mean, I'm sure it will be helpful. I mean, I'm reading one article and they're kind of framing it as like the Mary Poppins AI.
Yeah, like, right.
That is a great market employ though, because once you say it in that way, automatically like, oh, it seems more friendly than it actually is. Like, yeah, but interesting though, actually, you know, the Amazon 100 million subscriber and then they raise the price. It almost seems like they're just in an insurmountable position because, you know, if a company can raise their prices and there isn't a significant backlash or a drop off in, you know, consumers,
yeah,
then they've almost reached perfect stickiness essentially in their product. Like Netflix has raised their prices slightly every so often. It went to like $7.99 or $9 or whatever it was. Now Amazon's raising Prime. And if I ask most people, are you leaving these services? They're going to be like, not really. So it's like, boy, I'm not going to lie. I would recommend people own those stocks because like that's like,
yeah,
it's on a pure business side of it, it does bode well for them.
Not necessarily.
I'm not making a comment about whether that's a good thing for us as a society, but I'm just saying that like as an economic unit, like it's killing it really.
Yeah.
So I was reading an interesting article from the Atlantic about Slack. Slack is the messaging service that, you know, everybody knows and loves. And in terms of their diversity numbers, they've recently started to release them and they're absolutely killing it really. I'll quote some numbers here. So basically at Google, Facebook and Microsoft, women hold about 19% of the positions and 28% of leadership roles. Whereas at Slack, it's roughly around 31% for leaders and 34% for all technical roles. And their numbers in terms of ethnic minorities, African-Americans, Hispanic, Latino, it's almost triple that of those companies. And they've gone about it a few ways. So they've not open source, but they've kind of revealed what are their secrets, how they do it.
Yeah.
So one, which is so obvious, they don't just flipping hire at Stanford. It's like the most obvious thing in the world. They look for people who have skills, not what their academic pedigree was.
Yeah.
They go to boot camps. They go to, you know, there's one called, is it Grace Academy? Or there's a few like women-only boot camps that they go to and just boot camps in general. And they just open themselves up to a wider range of talent. And, you know, speaking to somebody who went, I had two academic experiences. I went to Kingston, which is a former polytechnic. It wasn't necessarily like seen as the greatest university in the world. And then I went to UCL, which is kind of seen as a more prestigious university for my master's. And the people that were the technical talent that I saw in both universities, the gap wasn't that great. In fact, I didn't necessarily, like, I came out of Kingston with people around me who are better engineers than people I saw out of UCL.
Interesting.
But if you're a recruiter at a Google, a Facebook, or
whatever,
you're going to be like, oh, the UCL people, of course. Like,
yeah.
Whereas, and I'm sure there's people coming out of boot camps that are, you know, they know Node.js like the back of their hand.
Yeah.
The UCL or Stanford graduate might be able to tell you about a linked list or some arcane computer science thing. But does it mean that when they start the job, they're going to know what they're doing? Probably not.
No.
Or there's no guarantee, at least, not to denigrate anybody that goes to those institutions.
Of course.
And then the other thing is they cut a whiteboard interview. The whiteboard interview is basically, here's a coding problem. Can you just go on this whiteboard and just like write it out?
Yeah.
Which is something you'll never have to do.
Yeah.
Like in your job.
I remember I had to do one when I interviewed Stripe for account management.
It's bullshit.
Like JavaScript.
It's nonsense. Like why would
fix
you like,
this query.
How was it like, what? Even to be honest, I hate, I remember I did an interview for a startup and he asked me some stupid riddle. Like it was some really silly riddle.
How
like,
many what? Tennis balls can fit into a swimming pool?
Exactly.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they kind of, if you want me to do an IQ test, just give me that.
Just give me the test.
Like, what are you doing? Like, how is this going to be reflective of how I do my job or what I'm capable of?
I am so judgmental of companies that do that. Like, one startup I worked at were like, oh, I want to ask, why shouldn't we hire you? And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to quit if you put that on the interview list.
Absolutely.
Like, what kind of stupid mind tricks are we just wasting people's time for? Like, what does that tell us about the candidate and how they're going to perform in the role?
And so the other thing that they did was they partnered with Textio. I don't know if we've mentioned them before, but
you mentioned them, for making sure that job ads are as inclusive as possible.
Yeah, so they pass through your job description ad and they kind of tweak it to make sure that you're not putting people off. We mentioned that last time with that data analyst role where they were talking about Mario Kart, right?
Yeah.
So for example here, some of the key phrases in a Slack job application job ad would be like cares deeply, lasting relationships versus Amazon's keywords, maniacal, and wickedly.
You're joking.
But you could tell in the Amazon one, it would be like, you must have a maniacal focus.
Yeah, that's so true.
You see what I'm saying? Like, and that's the kind of thing where like, you know.
And it is like that though,
Yeah. And so, I mean, to be honest, most of this stuff is common sense, but these small differences add up to eventually a massive difference in the number count. And also you know, you just briefly mentioned the questions that they ask at a job interview. So what they do is they've, they, because there is this thing called merit bias. I read up on it where they did a study at a police academy where people were being hired for the role of police chief. And when a man was interviewing a woman, they would say to him, they would ask the interviewer off-site, what is the most important value you're looking for? You're looking for education or experience. And when it was the woman, whatever value the woman had, whether it was education or experience, they would say the opposite.
Wow.
And then, yeah, and then when it was the man, vice versa, they would always like side with the man, for example.
Yeah.
So to remove that kind of potential bias where you're kind of just looking for what you want to look for.
Yeah. Basically, you want a man for the job.
Basically, right. So what they'll do is they'll say to the... Everybody in the company will get on board and say, okay, what are the key values for this role? Is it somebody who's empathetic? Is it somebody who's, you know, caring or driven? Once that's decided upon, the questions are set. Every single person who interviews for that role gets those questions.
Nice.
There's none of this time where you can just kind of, so what, you went to Stanford too? I went to Stanford. And you know, you can just go, I've used that to my advantage where I've gone down a riff of a job interview and used whatever commonality that we have. So Lord knows, like, you know, if it's somebody who's completely opposite to you, the struggle that might be there. So shout out to Slack. I mean, it's not perfect. Don't get twisted. Far from perfect.
Look, 31% of leaders as women, I've never worked at any company in all of the career that I've had that has had that level of representation. And certainly not since I joined tech. So look, it can be done. No more excuses. No more excuses. And, you know, it's funny if you're listening to this and maybe you're in HR or recruitment or people operations and you create policies, some of this stuff might seem obvious to you. But as someone that has experience at loads of tech companies, you know what? The number of companies that don't even have consistent processes for hiring people will shock you.
Yeah.
Will shock you. This idea of like, okay, these are the values that we need for this role. These are the questions we're going to ask. Let's be consistent.
Yeah.
Let's ask every candidate, regardless of, you know, what they look like, blah, 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 these questions, and then assess them accordingly. So many companies don't do that.
Yeah.
So many companies will send, you know, Sally in to interview Bob, Joe in to interview Jane. They're asking completely different questions. And then one of them's taking notes, another one of them isn't. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, because it's been busy and whatever, and no one's had time, we finally, you know, start a new Slack thread or jump on a Zoom call and go, right, who should we hire? And it's just like, that is not a perfect system. You know, that's, you know, as far from perfect system
as
you can have. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, we always talk about people being the most important thing in a company. You know, like, ooh, who are you going to hire? Your hires create your culture. Culture is everything. It's what pulls you through the tough times, blah, blah, blah. Okay, well, we say that, but why don't we put in the resources and the time that actually matches those words? You know, we need to put our money where our mouth is. And the fact is, like, for many startups, hiring the right person and creating the processes to ensure you're hiring the right people in a most inclusive way, you're still being cheap. And I'm talking to all of you founders, all of you CEOs, you are still cheap. Because when a consultant comes to you and tells you that they're going to help you design strategies to be inclusive, you don't want to work with them. Or you tell them that you can sort it out yourselves, or you want them to do it for free. Or you just delegate the responsibility of doing this to some underrepresented person in your company.
Actually, and let me...
And that is so, so messed up.
And guess what Slack
lazy.
Doesn't have?
What?
They do not have a chief diversity officer. Ooh.
Hallelujah.
They were like,
hallelujah.
So that's an interesting point, actually, the fact that you find that.
You should not need a diversity and inclusion person.
So, you know, the
your
way that...
Your CEO should be that person.
So they kind of frame it in the article as like, Slack says that it's such a core value for us that we are not going to delegate it to this one person. And it's an unenviable role. Like, is that, did I say that correctly? It's an
like
unenviable.
No one wants it.
Yeah, I wouldn't
of
want
course.
That role. Because I would feel like, well, I'm the only person in this company who's fighting that corner.
Yeah, exactly.
And fighting for resources where it's like, yeah, it probably should be the mandate of the company.
It should be the CEO's responsibility, the CEO's responsibility. Really, it should be everyone's responsibility. But, you know, the minute you delegate it out, it, like you said, it just means like, oh, it's not on my plate anymore, so I'll leave it to them. But yeah, you know, I just want to say, like, respect to Slack for actually, like, identifying this as a priority, putting the resources into it. And I mean, like, money and time resources into it. And I would love to work for Slack based on this information and, you know, assuming that they would continue this trend. And
but you're
loads
of product hunt though, right?
Huh?
You're loads of product
I'm
hunt.
Loads
yeah,
of product
yeah.
Hunt.
Okay, yeah. Shout out.
But,
I don't
like,
want to get in trouble.
No, like, you know, one of the things I love about Product Hunt and AngelList is that I work with Ryan, CEO of Product Hunt, and Kevin Laws, CEO of AngelList, to talk about ways to make the company more inclusive. You know, we don't have a diversity and inclusion person.
Mm.
Every single person in the company is invested in making this right. And, you know, particularly because of the work that we do, you know, we're building an online community. We're building the best place to recruit, to raise. Everyone has to be on that train. We're trying to like democratize, you know, all of these traditional processes, launching products, raising money, building teams. And there really aren't that many companies out there that can say they prioritize it this much. You know, there really aren't that many tech CEOs that have conversations about this every quarter or, you know, invest in training or whatever.
And we can't say that the things that they've done are that hard.
That's the thing that actually makes me like more, you know, outraged almost, because if you think of the long-term benefit that this will create for Slack, it's unrivaled, right?
Of course.
I mean, this is the beginning. They're laying the foundations of building a really, really inclusive company. They're not even that old.
Yeah, they're not.
So let's see 10 years from now the great things that this company will do. How long did it take them to do this? Erica Joy Baker must have left the company approximately a year ago or something. I'm sure her departure, she stayed there for less than a year. It was very publicized, you know, when she moved and then eventually onto Patreon. We were talking about this earlier. One of the reasons why she left was because she felt that the mobility that she needed in terms of advancing her career and getting ahead was not supported by the culture. So what did they do? They listened. They responded to that. She was a very high-profile person. She spoke about it publicly. They didn't get defensive. They were just like, yeah, fine, we own that. Let's fix it. They're also admitting they're not perfect yet, but they're saying, like, look, these are the things we've done. Everyone can do them. And this is what we've been able to achieve. So follow them. Don't just say you want to build the most successful company, or you want to solve this big problem, or you want to build a company that's here to last. Don't just say these things. Do the things that help you do that. And the people you bring in and hire and retain are critical.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to throw one last argument to any naysayers that would be listening to what we're saying. The engineer that may end up creating the feature that revolutionizes your business will not now be put off to join you. Like, you don't know the kind of talent that you're missing out on when you don't have these kind of inclusive practices.
Agreed.
If you look at, we said last time when we mentioned Uber, they didn't have the most inclusive company culture. And look what happened. It was like a house of cards. They scaled up so quickly. And part of the reason why the CEO lost his position was because he didn't prioritize this. So it was,
yes.
Even if I have to frame it in a purely self-interesting, in a way where it's purely about your own self-interest, I'm going to do that because the end goal is what matters.
You would be surprised. I mean, you literally would not be surprised, but people out there would be surprised, like, how many of the most talented young professionals and recent graduates are completely ignoring lucrative offers from big companies because they do not agree with, you know, the internal politics, the internal culture, or the lack of efforts to build inclusive cultures. And I'm not just talking about underrepresented people. I'm also talking about, like, straight, white, able-bodied guys that are just like, no. Like, I don't want to work in a place that's not treating everyone equally. So, you know, like you said, this is like a real, real, real risk because everyone's fighting for the top talent. But top talent, you know, they get a lot of offers. There's a lot of competition for them. And they're just like, okay, like, show me your inclusion stats. Show me where women are in your leadership. And that's certainly something that matters to me.
Preach. So. I'm finger snapping.
But, you know, the world is changing. And, you know, you got to change with it. Otherwise, you know, you're just missing out. You're missing out on really, really talented people. So, yeah, big up Slack and every company out there making similar moves.
For reals.
In fact, if you're working for a company that's doing great stuff in this space, I'd love to hear from you guys. Like, tweet us, hashtag TechishPod, go on TechishPod.com and email us. Whatever it takes, like, we want to educate people as much as we, you know, critique them and laugh. So
it would
be cool to learn other tactics that we can share.
Okay. So this is like a quick section, hustle tips. We haven't done it that often. I've only done it once, I think. Something that I picked up on, I was at a pre-screen showing of the rapper Kyla. He's a I guess I would have to describe him as a conscious rapper. I hate that term. He's released a film based off a comic book that he wrote called The Ruins of the Empire. So there was a pre-screening that I went to. And then the Q&A, somebody asked him, he's someone who's done music, books, you know, comic books. He's done everything, right? So someone said to him, how do you juggle all of these things? Like, how are you able to get so much done? You're an independent artist and you managed to get this done. He said something that I found quite interesting. He said, at the beginning of each year, I write down how many hours I want to dedicate to a certain thing. So if I want to work out a certain amount, I write down, I'm going to work out for this many hours in the year. I'm going to read for this many hours in the year. I'm going to work on this project for this many hours in the year. And what I liked about that was that he's saying that it's process over goals. So, so many of us write our goals down in the beginning of the year, which is, you know, quite commendable. I do that too. But you can't necessarily control your goals. Let's say you're an artist or you're a software engineer or a founder. You say, I want to sell this amount of units in this year. Can you really control that?
No.
Not really, can you? The universe is the universe. You might not be able to. You could put down, I want to sell 1 million units, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen, right? But what you can do is control the hours that you put into your craft.
The inputs, yes.
Correct. So he's saying, you know, this whole concept of the undisciplined artist that walks around and stumbles in, is high on heroin, and he comes to the studio and he makes beautiful music. Like, he's like, it's overrated. And I think most of us in our career, we can put this into good use. Like, for example, I'm trying to learn machine learning. So I'm like, you know what? I can't put down the goal at the end of the year. I want to be able to write this many programs, whatever, whatever. I should put down 2 hours a day or 1 hour a day focused on this.
For a year, so, and see where
and
that
see where you,
you
go. So I think it's a good mental switch from goals to process. And I thought it's a good...
I think what I like about that as well is that it like also like frames how you then reflect on that experience.
Mm.
Because if your goal was to have, you know, created some kind of neural network by the end of the year or whatever, and then you don't do that, you might be very disappointed and feel that the time was wasted.
Yeah.
But if instead you're just focusing on the inputs, so like, you know, achieve whatever, 50 hours of training, education, you know, then you actually are like, well, I've actually achieved that. I've done something.
So you've got another book coming out, right?
I do, yeah. So Dream Big, Hustle Hard 2.
Don't know. So how would you put this into practice then? Because you can't, let's say you can't, like in this example, you couldn't write down, I want to sell this amount of units. You'd have to put down what, for example?
I see what you mean. Well, I mean, maybe it's not the best example because I do want to finish the book this year. But like ways that I've done it is like, I just like, aim to write at least one sentence every day.
Yeah.
So when I write one sentence, it never stops with one sentence, right? Because you write one sentence, you write a paragraph. Some days it's just a paragraph.
Yeah.
Some days it's a whole page.
Yeah.
Other days it's 4 pages.
Yeah.
But, you know, like you said, it's about the process, it's the input. So if I make like a very achievable process, like write one sentence a day, then it's more likely that I'll do it. Surely it's the same when you're building.
And what about selling the book?
What do you mean?
As in what process could you write down?
Oh, I see. So like for this year, one of my processes was to do at least one speaking engagement every month.
It's dope, yeah.
And that way I have an opportunity to promote it. And it doesn't really matter whether it's at a university, at a co-working space, whatever, a small roundtable discussion, a big presentation like the one I did yesterday. And they're achievable. There's actually a good TED Talk on this. I'll put it in the comments when we post the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
But basically like a guy talks about how you shouldn't write down your goals. You should write down your strategies.
Basically, I think it's something that everybody should do. So yeah, shout out to Akala for that one. So we've got an audience question here, and I'll pose it to you, Abba. I would love to hear you both discuss your experience in education, primary school to uni. Did you always know you'd end up in tech?
So no, we've spoken about this a lot in the past. I definitely didn't know I would end up in tech. I never really know I'd end up in tech until a few weeks before I was offered the job.
We're just playing it by ear, you know. This is all accidental. Like,
yeah, at least you study computer science. I studied economics. I thought I was going to go work at a multilateral organization like the IMF or the World Bank and, you know, go work in less economically developed countries and create, you know, macroeconomic. I honestly, you know, at least when I was at university at the very beginning, I was like, okay, I'm going to like create macroeconomic policies to fight income inequality or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in primary school, I didn't even know what tech was. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'd seen a computer. I knew what computers were. But at that young age, the only jobs you know are the ones you see in cartoons or the world around you. I think the first job I wanted was like a fireman. Not even like firewoman. Like, I just...
Fire person.
You know when you say what you see? Fire person. Fire. When you're a kid, you just say what you see. So primary school, you know, if this is a question around what are the things I wanted to be when I was in education, primary school, fire person, like I said, then astronaut, like every other kid. Then in my teens, once I started discovering like pop culture and music, I wanted to just maybe be a celebrity or like some kind of artist. You wanted to be a rapper?
No, you wanted to be a rapper, I can tell.
No, I didn't want to be a rapper.
Okay.
Actually, I did want to be an actress for a very long time.
There we go.
Because I would still like to be an artist, maybe in another life. Like I would like to do something which is purely creative.
Hey, isn't this, it's not over yet? Why not?
I feel like I'm trapped now.
Nah,
but
life is long.
It was really only once I got out into the real world and I knew a bit more about myself, but also about the reality of working, where I kind of thought, I think this is the place that ticks all the boxes. So, yeah. What about you?
Yeah, even though I did study computer science, this was like, I went back to education after I'd been in the working world for a little bit. So in terms of primary school to uni, hell no, I didn't think so. My goal was always to start a business when I got old enough to realize what career that I want. So via that, I stumbled into tech because I realized that was the kind of, that was the way that young people were starting businesses. It wasn't, you didn't see many 20-year-olds with a corner shop or 20-year-olds, you know, starting large businesses with massive infrastructure. They did websites. And so I learned to code and that was it really. That's how I got the ball rolling.
What do you think influenced you wanting to become an entrepreneur?
Is it your family? So my father is an entrepreneur. So they do say that people that have entrepreneurs in their family are more likely to want to be entrepreneurs.
You're 10 times more likely to be an entrepreneur if one of your parents is one.
Yeah. And also my personality, like I'm very much...
impossible to manage.
Impossible, not impossible to manage. Maybe my former manager can say something. But I'm very much in this, like I question things a lot. I question my teachers a lot. So if I don't take instructions at face value, so if somebody gives me an instruction, I'm always thinking to myself, like, is that really the smartest way of doing things? Does that really make sense? Could we do things a bit better? So I always wanted to be like, no, I want to follow my own instructions.
Yeah.
So that was kind of that. I mean, and obviously don't get twisted, like entrepreneurship at one point did become kind of sexy. So that was probably a factor. But in terms of getting into tech, I think the person who asked the question, they did have a preamble that I didn't put down, but it was kind of along the lines of what can we do to change that so people can want to would know about it and get more involved from an early age. Because I feel like I wasted a lot of time.
Yes.
I didn't know about this stuff until I was already in my, like, you know, early to mid-20s.
Mm.
And Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates were working on this stuff when they were 13.
Yes.
You see what I'm saying? They were like, both of them, their history is that they both were working on this kind of stuff at a very young age. So how do we kind of combat that? Like, is it people going into schools like yourself, giving the talks?
I mean, definitely awareness is like a big part of it because, like I said, you say what you see, right? Mm. You say what you see. So when you're a kid, what do you want to do when you grow up? You just say what you've seen. I want to be a Power Ranger.
Yeah, I mean, but let's say for somebody who's old enough to understand, like, you know, when they're like, you know, 14, 15, 16.
But like 14, 15, 16 is also still quite young. Like you don't really know that.
Okay, 16,
many
17,
jobs.
18.
16, 17, 18. Like, I mean, a big part of this falls like on education and also like the education you have at home. So, your parents have to accept that tech is like a viable career path as well. And I think some people in other generations.
But even in school, for example, none of us were offered really computer science.
But some kids are coding now. Some kids are learning to code, things are changing, which is good. And I think we just need to see more of that. Like, it really just comes down to awareness. We just need there to be, like, more stories, you know, like the ones that you publish on People of Color in Tech, showing, like, hey, look, I'm this person, and this is my job, and this is what I do, just so that people recognize it. And we probably need to have more films and TV shows about people working in tech.
Yeah,
because I remember growing up watching Ally McBeal, and it was set in a law firm, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll be a lawyer.
Yeah.
But, like, there aren't that many shows set in a tech company. Halt and Catch Fire was one that was amazing, but now it's over. Then there's Silicon Valley, but then that's like on HBO, so if you don't have cable you can't watch it. So, you know, we just need, let's get some cartoons about startups.
Yeah, maybe
let's start young. Hey, if you're listening and you're an animator, techish cartoon, man, techish sitcom.
And because I remember being in school in the IT classes, it was literally just like Excel spreadsheets.
God, like Microsoft
Word. Yeah, it was like Microsoft Word.
Mail merge. I remember we learned how to do a mail merge.
But I think now, like, most of the kids are probably more aware of it in the sense that the technology is a bigger part of their lives. They carry around a supercomputer in their pockets at all times, and they know all the apps and everything. Change is coming. It's happening slowly. But there is still more work to be done, like you said, and you're a part of that. Hopefully I'm a part of that. And
that's why we need more tech in pop culture. I was actually so happy.
I mean, that's why we started this podcast, right?
That's what we said.
Tech-ish.
Name
of the game.
I would say one last thing. Janelle Monáe dropped her album, Dirty Computer.
Mm.
And I like that throughout all of her artistic career, she's always had this kind of like link between like analog and digital.
Yeah.
Her first album was Arc Android.
So it was like Android type stuff, right?
And she's very always kind of like looking to the future and bringing it in. And what's really, really cool in this new album is that she's also released what she calls an emotion picture. So like, I think it's like an hour long. I've watched it already and I really recommend you get on YouTube and watch it too. But she is challenging lots of the themes that we've talked about on this show around artificial intelligence and data and control. And, you know, she's a pop artist, but she's exploring these things through her video. So I would love to see more people doing that and just bringing people to a higher consciousness.
To be fair, even Black Panther might have an impact because that was very much based upon, you know, technology and the character of Shuri and whatnot. And
yes.
I see a lot of that in the atmosphere now. Everyone's like, yeah, we need to build a Wakanda and stuff like so. Yeah, all of it, hopefully in unison, will have an impact. I think we'll leave it there. Shout out for everybody for listening for episode 11. And
see you.
Subscribe and all that stuff.
Send your feedback. Share the podcast with a friend if you enjoyed the episode.
Yeah. All right. Ciao.
Bye.
Peace.